Well, 1993 has been on my mind quite a bit this week. With all the graduations that have already taken place and those that are about to take place. And since today is graduation Sunday, we have all our graduates sitting up front here in this service. I've been thinking about back to my own high school graduation, you know, what little bit I can still remember of that. And because, I mean, honestly, the details are a little fuzzy now, but what I do remember is that those were exciting times. Now it's a little sad because all these things are coming to an end, but you're, as soon as one chapter is closing, there's the beginning of this brand new chapter, and I and my friends were all headed off to various colleges and starting this new journey. Now, college was a culture shock for me. I grew up in a small town. I grew up in a small church. And in that context, everybody I knew pretty much looked like me. Not only that, but even though, you know, most of them were Baptist and I was Methodist, for the most part, everybody I knew believed like me. And that was not true when I got to college. In my freshman orientation group, there was a guy I met quickly from, a guy from the Philippines. He's the first person I'd ever met from the Philippines. And he was also the first Buddhist I'd ever met. And we became fast friends, but it was just an indicator that this was a different place. This was going to be a different experience. In fact, in my freshman class, there were two people who were Hindu. Another couple people were Jewish, and one guy from Pakistan was Muslim. And all of those were new to me. I'd never met anybody who practiced any of those religions, and so it was quite an interesting experience for me. Now, and not only people who practiced different religions and worshiped different gods, but it was also people who didn't worship any god at all. Before I went to college, I had never met any atheists. I don't know if there were any atheists in Lyman, South Carolina when I was growing up. But if there were, I didn't know any. Now, I knew some people for whom church was not the highest priority on their list of priorities, but I had never really met anybody who was antagonistic to the faith. But in college, some of my professors were atheists. So my professors were antagonistic to the faith. Now I went to Wofford College. It's a tiny school over in Spartanburg. So I was even insulated more than many of my peers who went to much larger universities in different parts of the country. I went to a small school, and I didn't even venture very far from home. In fact, Wofford is 18 miles from the home where I grew up. But I'll tell you, little Lyman, South Carolina felt a lot farther away than that by the time I got to Wofford. Because for me, college was this whole new world full of all sorts of new people and all sorts of new experiences. Now, I mentioned that to you this morning because in our passage from the book of Acts, we're going to see the Apostle Paul engaged in a new context. And for him, it's very different from the context in which he grew up, the context he's most recently coming from. It is, for Paul, a whole new world. Now, he's ventured more than 18 miles away from home. It's more like 1,800 miles away. He's ventured from Jerusalem all the way to Athens. That's Greece, not Georgia. And I'm glad you're awake. That makes me feel good. And while he's in Athens, he goes into the marketplace and he runs into these cultured elite, these educated intellectuals who have all sorts of different philosophies, who worship all sorts of different gods and idols. And when we pick up the passage this morning, they have just asked Paul to share with them about his faith, about his new teaching that he's been going around talking about. They ask him to share with them. And that's where we'll pick up in Acts chapter 17, verse 22. Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus and said, "Athenians, I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship as unknown, this I proclaim to you: the God who made the world and everything in it, He who is Lord of heaven and earth does not live in shrines made by human hands, nor is he served by human hands as though he needed anything, since he himself gives to all mortals life and breath and all things. From one ancestor he made all nations to inhabit the whole earth, and he allotted the times of their existence and the boundaries of the places where they would live, so that they would search for God and perhaps grope for him and find him, though indeed he is not far from each one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being, as even some of your own poets have said, for we too are his offspring. Since we are God's offspring, we ought not to think that the deity is like gold or silver or stone, an image formed by the art and imagination of mortals. While God has overlooked the times of human ignorance, now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed a day on which he will have the world judged in righteousness by a man whom he has appointed. And of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some scoffed, but others said, "We will hear you again about this." This is the word of God for the people of God. Thanks be to God. Now here's how I'd like for you to help me this morning. I'd like for you to turn to a couple people around you and deliver this message. The message is, you can't make this stuff up. Can you do that for me? You can't make this stuff up. Well, Paul, you can tell very quickly in this scripture passage that Paul is not in Kansas anymore. And neither is Paul in Jerusalem. He's in Athens. And Athens is a university town with a long history of great philosophers and thinkers and teachers. You know, people like Pericles and Plato and Socrates all grew up and taught in Athens. Athens is where the educated live. That's where the intellectuals who love ideas hang out. In fact, they love nothing more than to go to the marketplace and to sit around and debate new ideas and learn new things. And when Paul rolls into town, he's really not even planning on staying very long. He's just there long enough. He's waiting on his friends, Silas and Timothy. They're supposed to meet him there, and then they're going to continue their missionary work. And while he's there, he's struck by what he sees in Athens. In fact, we didn't read this verse, but I want to read it to you now. This is just prior to the passage we read in verse 16. This is what Paul said, or what Acts tells us. While Paul was waiting for them, that's Silas and Timothy, in Athens, he was deeply distressed to see that the city was full of idols. Paul's deeply distressed to see that the city of Athens is full of idols. Now, Paul has seen idolatry before, but this takes the cake. The place is crawling with idols. Some are stone, some are silver, some are gold. If the Athenians are anything like us, they're more than just those that they've created out of gold and silver and stone, because they can make idols out of anything. And sometimes I think we can make idols out of anything. Money, material things, even our own intellectual ability we can make idols out of. And I think that the Athenians were the same in that regard. Now, all of those things, all the gold idols and the silver and stone, all these images and idols that they've created are proof that the Athenians have never met an idea that they wouldn't debate, and they've never met a god they wouldn't worship. They even worship gods that they've never met, and they don't even know about. In fact, just to cover all their bases, Paul tells us that he's strolling through the city of Athens, and he runs across this altar, and there's an inscription on it, and it's an altar to an unknown god. You know, just in case, we're going to put that out there, and we'll worship this unknown god. But I want you to notice how Paul reacts to all this idolatry that he sees in Athens. Paul isn't adversarial. He doesn't blast the people for all the idols they've created. He doesn't blast them for worshiping other gods. In fact, he's very patient and very understanding. Even though they call him a babbler, he responds with patience and understanding to them. And this is verse 22. Then Paul stood in front of the Areopagus. Now, this also is known as Mars Hill. Some of you have heard of Mars Hill before. It's a rocky cliff that overlooks the city of Athens. And sometimes people were taken up to the Areopagus, to Mars Hill, to be tried for crimes that they may or may not have committed. Sometimes they go up there to hold court just to debate ideas and share philosophies. So Paul is there at the Areopagus, and he says to the Athenians, "I see how extremely religious you are in every way. For as I went through the city and looked carefully at the objects of your worship, I found among them an altar with the inscription to an unknown God." You know, they just want to make sure they got all the idols and gods covered. And then Paul says to them, "What you therefore worship as unknown, I proclaim to you." In other words, Paul takes their search, their quest for truth, their quest for worship, and he uses that unknown God altar as an open door to share with them about the God that he knows, the creator of the universe, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who became flesh and lived among us, who lived to show us how to live and then died and then 3 days later was raised from the dead. Paul uses that as an open door to share with them about Jesus. So Paul says, you want to know about this unknown God? You want to know about this God for whom you've built this altar? You don't even know his name, but I'm going to tell you about him. He is the God who created everything there is. This God is the Lord of heaven and earth. This God doesn't live in shrines made by human hands. And this God doesn't even need human hands to serve him because he doesn't need anything. In fact, not only is this God not created by human hands, but this God created us and breathed into us the breath of life. And this is the same God who raised Jesus from the dead. And that's where this whole thing starts to derail just a little bit for Paul. I mean, the Athenians are used to idols. They're used to creating all sorts of gods. Idols are gods we create. And we create gods in our image, gods that will serve us, that will protect us, that will give us the things that we want to cater to our whims. The Athenians are used to that. They're used to creating idols. But they get a little bit skeptical when Paul starts talking about this God who's not created by them, but the God who created them and the God who breathed life into them. They get a little bit skeptical, but it's not until a little bit later that they really just kind of turn off, shut down. They shut down when Paul starts to talk to them about the resurrection of Jesus. Because when they hear about the resurrection, in verse 32, this is what it says. When they heard of the resurrection of the dead, some scoffed. Some in that group, some of Paul's audience scoffed. They laughed at him. They thought he was crazy. See, the Athenians are open-minded to a point. They're open-minded, but they're not that open-minded. They'll go so far. They'll talk about all kinds of idols and gods, but let's don't start talking about the crazy things like resurrection from the dead. I mean, they're intellectuals who love new ideas and love to debate, but when they hear Paul talk about the resurrection of Jesus, that's just a little bit too much. So they scoff. You know, earlier I mentioned to you that I met all kinds of new people when I went to Athens. I mean, college. I met all kinds of new people. And I have to say, I learned from all of them. I was challenged by some of them. I already told you that a couple of my professors were atheists, and that was good for me. Because they challenged me, and they forced me to look at the world in different ways, through different lenses. They sharpened me. But it might have been my religion professors who challenged me the most when I think back on it. I'll never forget the first religion class I took. It was Intro to the Old Testament. And during the course of that semester, I learned some unsettling things. And they were unsettling, but that doesn't mean that they weren't true. You know, you can, those two things are not mutually exclusive. In fact, Andy Stanley says if you want an example of this, there's a prime example of things that are true and yet unsettling, and that a prime example of that would be your teenage daughter's boyfriend. Because it's true, she has a boyfriend. And then you meet him, and that's unsettling. Both of those things are true at the same time. And I learned some things. I encountered some things. I bumped up against some things in college that were, they might have been true, but they were also unsettling to me. For example, I learned that the creation story in Genesis was never intended to be a scientific account of how God created the world. It was not intended to be a detailed account of this is exactly how it happened. In fact, in Hebrew, if you read Genesis in its original language, it's a poem. It's a poem displaying the beauty and of the handiwork of God and the intentionality of the Creator behind the creation, but not a step-by-step guide of how it all happened. Now, up until that point in my life, I thought that Genesis was like a science textbook, and if you believe the Bible, then it necessarily puts you at odds with the people in the science department. And then I realized that wasn't true. And it was a little bit of a relief, but it was also unsettling. I'll tell you what was more unsettling than that was when we learned that in the book of Exodus, when Moses was leading the Israelite people out of slavery in Egypt, and they were being chased by Pharaoh's armies, what I learned was in the original Hebrew, it says that God parted the Reed Sea instead of the Red Sea. That was unsettling to me. Because I had seen the movie and I saw Charlton Heston standing in front of the Red Sea and all these walls of water on both sides, and all of a sudden the thought that it might not have been the Red Sea, maybe it was the Reed Sea, and maybe it doesn't make it any less miraculous that God delivered the Israelite people from the armies of Pharaoh, but it was still unsettling. There were all kinds of things that were unsettling to me in college, things that rattled my faith and gave me pause. But at the end of the day, do you know what gave me comfort? Do you know the thing that kept me grounded in my faith, even though faith was being assaulted on all sides by all those those professors? The thing that kept me grounded was the resurrection. That's right. The very same thing that caused the Athenians to scoff at Paul gave me comfort. See, the Athenians are proof that we humans are very good at creating idols. We like to make idols out of all sorts of stuff. We like to create God in our image, a God who will do the things we want God to do. But then Jesus comes along, and he's nothing like any God we would have ever made up. He's not like any God we would have imagined. He's not a God that we would create in, because he's not in our image. Who would ever have created or imagined, fabricated a God who would be so difficult? A God who would say things like, hey, if you want to be my disciple, you're going to suffer. It's not going to be easy. In fact, if you want to follow me, you have to take up your cross every day and follow me. Well, if I was going to create a God, I'd create one that was going to make it easy, not hard. So who would fabricate a God who would spend his entire ministry going to the least, the last, and the lost? Who would spend time with the poor and the outcast to the neglect of the elites of his day? Who would fabricate a God like that? Who would create a God who would say things like, the last will be first, and the first is going to be last? Who would create a God who would say to somebody who wants to be his disciple, okay, you can be my disciple, but just one thing, because I love you so much, here's what I want you to do. Take everything you have and sell it and give the money away, and then you could come be my disciple. Who would fabricate a God like that? This isn't the kind of idol. This isn't the kind of God we would create or the kind of God we would fashion for ourselves. Furthermore, nobody would ever make up a God who suffers and dies a humiliating death on the cross. You can't make this stuff up. And then there's the resurrection. The sticking point for the Athenians, the news that though Jesus was crucified and though he died and was buried, the grave couldn't hold him. God wouldn't let that be the last word. And God raised him triumphantly from the dead, giving victory to us. Then there's that. Now, I know that in our day, people hear that and they do the very same thing that the Athenians did. They scoff. How could you possibly believe that? But think about this. Why are you here today? You're here because people who witnessed the resurrection, people who saw Jesus after his death, who got to touch his side and handle the scars in his hands, we are here because those people shared that story of Jesus' resurrection with everybody they came in contact with, and that story spread through the entire world and from generation to generation. You are here because people witnessed and would not stop talking about the resurrection of Jesus, who was God in the flesh, who lived to show us how to live and died, but then was raised from the dead. You're here because the very first witnesses to that, the very first people to see Jesus after the resurrection, who had breakfast with him on the beach, those people told that story as far and wide as they possibly could, even though they were threatened with torture and death because of it. You couldn't stop them from telling people about Jesus and his resurrection. In fact, all of the very first followers of Jesus, except one, the Apostle John, all the rest of them died a martyr's death. They were brutally killed because they wouldn't stop talking about Jesus and the resurrection. Now, I'm just thinking, if I fabricated a story about somebody who was crucified and then resurrected, then I might tell it to some people. I might share it with a lot of people. But if you threaten to torture me, or you threaten to kill me unless I stop talking about it, I'm going to stop. I'm going to be like, you know what, I was just kidding. I made it all up. Please let me go. But that's not what the first disciples of Jesus did. If it were me, the only way I would be willing to be tortured or killed is if I am 100% convinced that this story and this event is absolutely true. And disciple after disciple of Jesus were convinced. And they were killed because they wouldn't stop talking about the resurrection. Now, I understand some of the philosophers of Paul's day, and I understand why they would scoff at this story when he starts talking about the resurrection. I understand why they'd be skeptical. But I also understand that in this gathering this morning, I bet there are more than just a few men in this space who are named Paul or Peter or James or John. I bet we have some Marks in here. I bet we have a couple of Lukes. But I don't know anybody named Pericles. I don't know anybody named Socrates or Plato. And the Athenian philosophers with whom Paul is engaging there at the Areopagus, we don't even know their names. They're lost to history forever. But not the disciples. Not the witnesses of the resurrection, because they might have killed them, but they couldn't stop them. Because you can't make this stuff up. Now, most of us in this room are not about to head off to college, and we're not about to be bombarded with new ideas and philosophies. But we do sort of live in Athens. Because more and more we're surrounded by a diversity of ideas, a diversity of religions, people who worship all sorts of different things. And in the context of our Athenian-like culture, I want you to remember how Paul engaged. Again, Paul wasn't adversarial. He didn't attack anybody. He didn't criticize anybody for what they believed. In fact, he affirmed their impulse and their drive to believe something. He affirmed their quest for truth. And when they asked him to share, he was ready to tell them about Jesus and his resurrection. Now, to them, I am sure that this story about the resurrection was unsettling. But that doesn't mean it wasn't true. That doesn't mean it isn't true. Because you can't make this stuff up. Class of 2017, you're about to go off to Athens. Now, you're going to call it different stuff. You're going to call it Winthrop and PC and Wofford and USC and whatever that other school is over there. And as you prepare to go, just know this. Nothing you learn can change the fact that God became flesh and lived among us because He loved us so much. And nothing you learn can change the good news that Jesus not only lived to show us how to live, but died on our behalf so that we might have life, and that the grave could not hold Him. That God raised Him from the dead. And the first witnesses of that were willing to die for that message. No matter what you learn, no matter what you encounter, you can't make this stuff up.